There's more than just a basketball game going on here at Fiserv Forum. The Bucks are giving out free COVID vaccinations. Milwaukee is among the NBA franchises with the highest number of players and staff vaccinated. About 70% of NBA players have gotten at least their first shot. And Mike, they're certainly hoping that number goes up before the playoffs.
The NBA playoffs start 2 weeks from Saturday, but some shots have already determined what will happen on the court. At the center of the sport's vaccination effort is one man, Dr. Leroy Sims, the head of medical affairs for the NBA, the man who's overseen every aspect of the league's response to COVID-19. So today, the doctor in charge of the health of the entire NBA shares exactly what this pandemic has taught him and where we go from here. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, May 6th. This is ESPN Daily. Dr. Leroy Sims, thank you so much for talking to me today, man. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here with you. This is truly a pleasure.
Well, listen, you are the medical director of the National Basketball Association. That is a job you've held since 2018. That is a job that I did not have that many questions about in like 2019. But now I have many questions for you. And I just want to start off pretty basically. What has your day-to-day been like? Because you're trying to keep everybody safe during this pandemic that we're still going through, obviously.
So it will depend on the day. Some days I continue to work in the emergency department. So there are days where I'm not wearing my NBA hat and I'm actually working in the ER. But when I'm not doing ER shifts, a typical day will start off with meetings and briefings as it relates to what's happening with COVID, interacting with not only our NBA staff and personnel, but our affiliated leagues. We have the WNBA, the G League, 2K, and about to launch the Basketball Africa League. So the day is filled with meetings on those fronts. Some days I will do presentations to our various groups, whether it's our staff, our referees, our players, about COVID, even doing Q&As. So the days do vary in terms of what the workflow looks like, but it's intense.
So hold on. You've described a globe that you are sort of monitoring, a literal planet of basketball that falls under your purview, but also that you're an emergency room doctor. For those who aren't familiar with how you're balancing this, what does the ER section of your life still resemble?
The ER is my bread and butter. I love working in the ER. One of the things that I always wanted to do was to be able to help people in any situation. And I know that sounds very, you know, quotidian. You want to help people. But what I mean by that is if I'm in a grocery store, if I'm on an airplane, if I'm on a bus and something happens, I'm able to intervene and help that person, at least to be able to stabilize them. And that's what I was always interested in.
You know, Dr. Sims, it reminds me, I grew up the son of doctors. I unfortunately found no medical angle on my current profession. You did the dream that they probably still hold out for me. But I remember like being on a plane and an emergency happening and my dad being the guy. And I just remember this immense singular pride that I felt. And I imagine for you, that sense of pride also probably extends to what we just saw last year with the NBA bubble, like this sports science experiment in America that seemed to be the vanguard of how America was dealing, figuring out ways to deal with the coronavirus. Just how far in the rear view does that feel to you? Does it feel like it was a million years ago? Does it still feel like you're still kind of in it?
It still feels like I'm in it. And primarily because we continue to draw from that experience of being in Orlando. When we set up events, whether it's the bubble or the NBA finals, our global games, you name it. We start at the 30,000 foot view, start with the forest and get down to the trees. What will people need day in and day out? How can we do it in the context of making sure people don't have to leave the bubble? When we were in Florida, there were a lot of cases in the community, and so we needed to be fairly contained. And we had to bring a lot of resources into that bubble, onto that campus, that we typically wouldn't necessarily need to have on the campus, like CT scanners and MRI machines.
So looking back at the bubble, what is underrated about that experience? What is sort of being under-considered about it?
I think the challenge of living away from home that long, because we had people who did 100 plus days in the bubble. It was a challenge for our players. It was a challenge for our staff. Toward the end of the bubble, we made arrangements to allow them to have a small number of family to come in and join them. And I recall, I can tell you as clear as day, how different that campus became. It was tremendous seeing guys out with their kids. You know, we had a little putting green, we had cornhole, we had the pools. It was just a different feel altogether. You know, for me, it was almost 80 days away from home. Until you've had to do it, you really can't quite appreciate how much of a sacrifice that is for your family to give you up, but for you to be away as well and committed to your work.
So when you think of the virus now, Dr. Sims, how are you able to characterize the impact of infection on athlete health and performance? How do you begin to break that down?
The virus is shifty. That's how I characterize the virus. But we know that some people have no symptoms, no impact in terms of people's day-to-day lives and performance. We also know that people can be symptomatic, or they can have what's called long hauler syndrome, where they're experiencing chronic fatigue, shortness of breath, headaches, dizziness and confusion. And that definitely can have an impact on players. Jason Tatum has spoken about that. And so we know that you're not immune, even if you're a young, healthy athlete, from the detrimental impacts of the coronavirus. It is for that reason that we continue to strongly encourage not just our players, but everyone to be vaccinated to protect you against that. The benefits of the vaccine are tremendous. The risks are very small. The risk of COVID are significant, and we should be able to protect ourselves from that.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the vaccine in the way that you just sort of alluded to, because when you are dealing with athletes who tend to be young and healthy in general, and I think it's safe to say also athletes, they are at the top of their profession, the guys that you're dealing with, there can be a sense of confidence, let's put it. And for you, what do you find to be the common questions or concerns when it comes to how athletes may be cautiously considering the vaccine as a concept?
We took our vaccine education campaign to team by team. I presented for 30 minutes to each team individually to be able to arm them with helpful information, give them the data, and to stand there to answer any questions they would have. And so their questions reflected questions that you might have or questions I had before I got the vaccine. They asked questions like, how do we know this is safe? How do we know that a year from now, I'm not going to experience some type of problem related to getting this vaccine? Keep in mind, for these athletes, their body is their paycheck. So it's only natural that we anticipate they're going to ask questions about what could be going into their bodies. But they do want to know. I had a really, really great question from a player who will go nameless. But he said, Doc, if we're young and we're healthy and everyone around us is getting vaccinated and we reach herd immunity, why don't we just wait for that point? And that's a very thoughtful question, because we had talked about what herd immunity means. And so that player was going, well, let me make some calculated risks. And so the questions have just been great. They've wanted to know if I was coming to them, if I was sent to talk to them because I'm a black doctor, you know, and sensing, you know, is this because of, you know, the hesitancy that we're seeing in the communities? And I told them, no, this wasn't me coming to them as a black doctor. This is me coming to them as a doctor they have seen, a doctor who they know. They saw me on Zooms before the bubble. They saw me in the bubble. They see me at All-Star. They see me at Combine. They see me at Summer League. They asked me, would this impact my fertility? How is this going to impact my performance? I was willing to answer any and all of those questions, and I think it made a difference because the message of being vaccinated is important, but the messenger is also important, and I think that resonated with our guys.
I wanted to dive in domestically a little bit deeper on the Black experience as vaccination is concerned, and you began to speak to this, but certainly there is a history that I think is worth being aware of, a fraught history of interaction between Black Americans, African Americans, and medicine as this institution. How do you begin to explain the troubled history that I just referred to, and also where we are now and why that is not a thing to be concerned about in the context of vaccine?
We can't ignore the history. In fact, we learned from it. And we know that for a very long time in this country, Black Americans, African Americans were seen as people upon whom experimentation should take place, people for whom treatments should be withheld. And that was the Tuskegee experiment. Remember, the Tuskegee experiment was taking people who had syphilis and simply observing what happened naturally and withholding penicillin. We had a cure, and that was withheld. And so that skepticism of how do I know that you have my best interest at heart, that resonates. We saw that women were being experimented on in the development of gynecological surgical tools. Black slaved women. And then those tools, once perfected, were taken to Europe and used on women, but with anesthesia. They didn't use anesthesia on those enslaved women. And so the history is long in terms of our interaction with the healthcare community. But it's also not just a history, it's a now story. Look at Black longevity. Look at infant mortality. Look at chronic medical diseases. These are all things that we have in the Black community that are disproportionately high compared to other communities. And so that is what informs people's hesitation, not just with the vaccine, with healthcare in general. And people say, well, you know what? I'd rather take my chances than go see someone who's not going to respect me and treat me as a human. We have to get into the communities and show that we are trustworthy and that we want to partner with the people in the community and we have their best interests at heart. That's how we start to bridge the gap.
All right, after the break, more from Dr. Sims on fans at live sports and herd immunity and fighting vaccine disinformation.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So looking at vaccinations across the NBA, Dr. Sims, the most recent number we've heard is from Adam Silver, who said that more than 70% of players have received at least one dose. And I know that all types of employers and organizations across America, they're all grappling with how to get their vaccination rates up. But in the case of the NBA, I know it's currently the personal choice of players whether to get it or not. So tell me more about that.
I think it's tough to mandate a vaccine. I think that it's a tough position to be in. I do understand that when you get down to a legal question that some institutions may legally have the right, but I also don't think that we want to be in the position of forcing people to take the vaccine. Why do I say that? Let's say we get to a point that a booster is needed. Are you going to force people to take the booster? You get probably one shot to make people do stuff. But if you take that shot and it turns out, oh, I need you to do it again and again, then you're going to have a problem. And that's where I think the education comes in. Allow people to make an informed decision. And if they understand the vaccines benefit me and no, it's not the government implanting a chip in my arm, they understand why that's not the truth and that's not reality. You stand to serve people better. And if we start from, well, I heard it on the internet, that's one thing. Or someone got the shot and they had this reaction in their arm and they started to act differently, then we can get into that. Like, what were the adverse events from the shot? But let me understand where you're coming from. But this is debate, right? You have to start with the argument, not the person. You can't tell someone like, you're crazy, like that doesn't make any sense. You're never going to reach them. You have to listen. And that is more than half of my job, is I have to listen and get information, synthesize that information, and then be able to make an assessment. People ask me, hey, I have a quick question. And I tell them there is no quick question in medicine. Because if you ask me, can I take this acetaminophen? I'm going to go, well, what past medical history do you have? What surgical history have you had? Have you been sick recently? What medications are you taking? Do you have any liver problems? Is anything running your family? I have to ask all these questions in order to make an assessment.
I was thinking about all of this because we had Dr. Fauci on the podcast last year, and he had referenced the hope that athletes could be helpful. I saw Dr. Fauci recently talk to Marshawn Lynch.
Well, what's happening, man? You got Marshawn Lynch here, man. It's a pleasure to meet the Dr. Fauci himself. You understand me? What's happening, big dog?
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Marshawn.
No problem. Did you
understand? What's your sense of how important publicizing athlete NBA player vaccination is and could be?
First and foremost, I'm a doctor, and my priority is the care of the patient. So my first objective is to make sure you, Pablo, and anyone else get vaccinated. If you have questions about vaccination, that we address those. We get rid of disinformation and dispel any myths to help you make an informed decision. So that's my priority, number one. Then we can start to think about reaching out to the community and having a bigger impact, sort of the next level of the concentric circle. We know that our legends, we know that our players, we know that there are influencers in society, and yes, that has an impact. But at the same time, I don't feel there should be an obligation for someone to deliver a message of, hey, do this. It's a personal decision, and the priority is the individual getting vaccinated. And if enough of us as individuals get vaccinated, we will be fine.
It does feel, Dr. Sims, like sports can often serve as a weather vane of normality. The idea that when we see fans cleared to re-enter the building in the way that we're used to, that will be the sign that, okay, we're getting back in the direction that we're used to. How close to normal do you think we're going to be as the playoffs are sort of on the horizon this season in the NBA?
So I feel very good about the path that we're on, the trajectory. But even though cases are low and we're in that 60 to 70,000 case a day, that's still pretty high. It's lower than the 250,000 cases a day, but it's still high. And when we look around the globe, look at what's happening in India. We can't forget about that this pandemic goes on. Look at what's happening in the upper Midwest. Look at what's happening in Latin America and on the African continent. But look, we have fans in our buildings, and at the beginning of the season, we did not. So that's progress, and I'm all about the progress.
The message of herd immunity, Dr. Sims, that feels like a concept that our listeners also could benefit from a little education on. How would you begin to describe what that is and how do we reach it?
The layman's definition of herd immunity is this. If 10 of us are together in a room and I have COVID, I may be able to infect the person to my right, but neither one of us can infect anyone else in the room. And so in that instance, the room has 80% herd immunity. And that is essentially what we're trying to get to, the point where any one individual can infect, on average, less than one person. Right now in the United States, I think we're at about 26% of individuals fully vaccinated. And so that's a far cry from maybe the 75 or 80% that we'll need to reach herd immunity. Really, we're in a race against the virus. As long as the virus is in circulation, it's going to continue to mutate because that's what viruses do. They mutate. And if we can get to the point where fewer people are susceptible to infection, then we start to starve out the virus. And the virus doesn't have anywhere or anyone that it can impact. But look, if we in the United States hit herd immunity 80%, but we don't have herd immunity around the globe, with globalization and travel, we're still going to be at risk from the impacts of the virus.
When you think about what you have learned, just lesson-wise, is there something that occurs to you now as like, oh man, this is what I had to learn in order to do this job that I didn't know before, thanks to the entire pandemic experience?
There isn't one thing that I have learned and taken away. I've learned several things. I think what's first and foremost that the pandemic has really highlighted for me was the importance of human connectedness. And for me, being home for this extended amount of time and having this amount of time to spend with my wife and my two daughters, very important. Not being able to travel to Chicago to see my grandmother over the holidays, or to travel to Florida to see my parents, and having it be so long since we've been together, I just so much value that. Hugs. I mean, not being able to hug people, you know, how awkward it gets when you come up to people, like, do you forearm bump, or what do you do? Like, just think of what it used to be when you dap someone up, bring them in close. You can't do it anymore.
Like, this gets me to the most important question perhaps of the day, which is that Commissioner Adam Silver was famous, Dr. Sims, for his mastery of dap. He spoke dap fluently in a way that distinguished him. What are the policies around DAP going to be, do you think, as we head forward into this brave new world?
I will say that Commissioner Silver had pretty great DAP game. Like, it was. I mean,
legitimately impressive.
Yeah. You know, considering the fact that our hands are one of the primary vehicles by which we can infect ourselves, your hands are very valuable in keeping you safe. So look, I do hope the DAP comes back, the DAP and the half hug or whatever it's called. I'm looking forward to that, but I don't see that on the horizon anytime soon. I really appreciated how public health sentiment changed its nomenclature to go from socially distant to physically distant, because we need to socialize with each other. We don't need to be socially distant. It was more of a physical thing, and it speaks to that importance and what messaging really can mean.
Dr. Sims, thank you so much for your time, for your explanations, for your wisdoms. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to have come on. And you, as a Filipino, as a Harvard grad, that very much resonates with my wife, who's Filipina and a Harvard grad. So, like, I've won major points with this one.
Well, you know what? I'm going to make sure my parents hear that part so they can stop telling me that I need to go to medical school.
It's not too late, though. It's not too late.
That's the issue. They always say it's not too late. One update here. Since we recorded our interview with Dr. Sims last week, the share of fully vaccinated Americans has risen from 26% to 32%. And you will hear more from Dr. Leroy Sims and me next month on the National Geographic podcast, Overheard. It's going to be a story on Olympic training during the pandemic. Okay, up next, Jeff Passan provides an update on what he calls the most important baseball story he will ever report.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. A few months ago, we told you the story of Drew Robinson, the former Texas Rangers player who bounced around between the pros and the minors for years, all while living with mental illness. About a year ago, Drew Robinson attempted suicide and lived.
I'm supposed to help people. I'm supposed to help people get through something that doesn't seem winnable. I'm meant to be alive. I'm meant to be alive.
And now there is breaking news about exactly what Drew Robinson is meant to do. So I asked Jeff Passan, who reported his story, to tell us more. So, Jeff, we talked with you about Drew Robinson on this podcast and about his return to baseball a few months ago, but now there is an update that I need you to explain to us. What is happening with Drew?
I'll just read the lead of my news story here. Drew Robinson, who lost his right eye in a suicide attempt last year, made the opening day roster for the San Francisco Giants AAA affiliate, and could play as soon as Thursday when the Sacramento Rivercats open their season with a six-game series in his hometown of Las Vegas. Take that all in. Just think about all of the different elements there, Pablo, that we're dealing with. Drew Robinson, who lost his right eye in a suicide attempt last year. This is somebody who, for a long time, was not sure he would ever play baseball again, who for a day when he was clinging to life was not sure if he wanted to live. And here he is, not just alive, but back playing baseball for the San Francisco Giants, one step away from the best team in the National League thus far this season. It's an incredible story. It's always been an incredible story, and it just keeps getting better.
Hey, Jeff, I want to hold on here for a second because the idea of a baseball player with one eye existing, flourishing, that's not something I knew could even really happen.
Yeah, and I went to watch his first spring training game. I was in the Phoenix area, and we went out to dinner that night. And it was really interesting to see where he was mentally. I think a lot of what he's learned in the past year prepared him for this moment. But what did concern me was the reality that for the first time in the last year, Pablo, he was going outside of this comfort zone. And here, this was the real world. This was more than 100 other professional baseball players there trying to show that they're better than him. This was opponents trying to avoid having to say, a guy with one eye hit a home run off me. And this was a no-holds-barred situation where they were not going to give him preferential treatment simply because he was a good story. He had to earn his way. And the fact that he overcame some really trying moments early on and convinced Giants management that he was the right guy for this roster spot, I think is a testament to him and illustrates the growth that he has had.
How has Drew been playing?
Early on, it was interesting because early on, the Giants believed that his best chance at making a roster was going to be as a utility player. And that in order to be an effective utility player in the minor leagues, you have to play shortstop. And Drew hadn't played shortstop in a long time regularly. And he was having trouble there. But during batting practice, he would hit the ball hard enough where he knew that it was there. And during games, interestingly enough, you know, what's the term, Pablo, for somebody who takes a lot of walks in baseball, he's got a good eye.
Mm.
Drew Robinson was taking a lot of walks, and he was able to look in the mirror and say to himself, I've got a good eye. And that part is what really, I think, as much as anything, gave him the hope and the belief that he was going to be okay. The fact that he can discern the difference between ball and strike with only one eye. And I think the day he hit his first home run, it was beautiful. Like it was a beautiful, majestic swing, and the ball absolutely flew. That told him, hey, I can do this. But he understands the first thing that he has to do is play his way into regular playing time and to show that he can be productive enough. And that is far from a guarantee at this point.
So, Jeff, this was the story that you called the most important story you will ever work on. So what should we know at the very end here?
This isn't the very end, Pablo. This is just the beginning. This is like the second inning of Drew Robinson's baseball game. And I'm not sure if he's going to spend the next 10 years on the field doing things and defying expectations like he did when for 20 hours he fought to stay alive and wound up doing so. What I am pretty sure about, though, is that whatever Drew Robinson does, it's going to be important and it's going to be interesting, and he's going to really appreciate everything that he has because he earned it. And he got there by doing things the way that he was meant to do them.
Jeff Passan, thank you as always for being here today with us.
Thanks, Pablo.
You can catch a replay of our podcast episode called Alive, The Drew Robinson Story. We'll have it in the ESPN Daily podcast feed right here on Saturday. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.